These are a few lines from a poem entitled Eclipse by Angela Jackson. We carry the news with us. It sits in the eyes like cold tears, like the lake at midnight. In the dark, thick and cold, we say we see through. As we study the company of stars in the northern American sky, we blow into our hands and say and pray that we evolve. I sat down at a cafe yesterday afternoon to work on the draft of my sermon for a little while my little boy and his dad took a rest. And I exchanged pleasantries with the man at the neighboring table, and then settled in with my cup of tea. And then after a while, I got up for another cup of tea, and as I sat back down, he said, "It looks like you're writing. Are you a writer?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Oh, what are you working on?" And this is usually a conversation stopper, a sermon. He said, "Oh, are you a preacher?" I said, "Yeah, yes." "Oh, well, what's your sermon about?" So I started to explain the sort of complicated document I had in front of me. And he said, "Well, you know what you could preach about." Which is usually not that welcome a comment. But this time he was right. He said, "You could preach about the shooting in Charleston." And I said, "Well, I've written a prayer for that in the service." And he said, "That's good." And then he said, "You know, what do you think? Why do you think he did that? Why do you think he went to the church to shoot people?" And the way he asked it, I realized that he really wanted me to answer that question, because I've been asking that question in a way, a rhetorical way, like, can't answer it. But he wanted to know if I had an answer for him. So I gave him my usual theory, which isn't quite enough. But I said, "It seems to me that most people who commit these outrageous acts of violence, that someone or someones have been pretty brutal to that person, probably starting from the moment they were born. And so their minds got a little warped about how the world goes and how we act in the world. And they also began to think of themselves as a victim, because as a young person, they were. But then they grow up, and they're no longer victims. They're powerful people, and in this case, a young white male in the United States is the most privileged person there is. And so there he is thinking of himself as a victim, but he's actually a person with a fair amount of power in our society. And that's a dangerous combination, privilege and thinking of yourself as a victim. It's the confusion that I think we hear from the NRA. It's the confusion that I think is behind the idea that gets put out periodically that kindergarten teachers should have guns. Well, my companion nodded thoughtfully at my theory. And then he said, "There's just too much anger. I think we have to figure out how to mass market love." I think that might be the phase two of the UUA's campaign about standing on the side of love. We're going to mass market it. And then he said to me, "Well, if you had been that minister, if you had been in the church, and this man had stood up with a gun, what would you have said to him to stop him?" Well, I thought, first I said, I think at that point there's nothing you can say. When you're at that moment, there's probably no way to stop that. But then I thought I might say, These are not the people you think we are. This is not the place you think it is. Because I think the only way someone can do something like that is if they're profoundly confused about the people that they're with. And that maybe I could introduce a moment of doubt, a moment to pause and orient himself, and maybe in that moment, rather than words stopping something, maybe someone could physically stop it. I don't know. My companion suggested, however, that maybe someone should say something about God or about love. I said, well, if someone has come into a church with a gun, I didn't think that saying something like that would probably make a difference. That probably the kind of love that the man at the next table in the tea shop or the people in that church were feeling wasn't going to register. So then he talked about what would someone who was a hostage negotiator say. And he wanted to get Anderson Cooper. Am I saying the name right? I had to confess to him that I didn't have a TV, so I wasn't as up on all of this as he was. He wanted him to interview some hostage negotiators to see if they could say, what would you say in that moment? What's the thing that you could say that would change things? And then he asked, this is a 15-minute conversation over tea, why would God let this happen? Why didn't the gun fail? So then I was faced with a complicated conversation about the nature of God and the nature of humanity. And so I said, well, that's the old dilemma about God. God can be all-knowing, all-powerful, or all-good. You can pick two of those, but you can't have all three. The world shows us that you can't have all three. And then I said, I don't think that God controls every event. If you look at the world, it sure looks like that's the case. I think that God is something else, something that works differently than controlling the outcome of events. Something that's quieter that each of you carries. So then I had to explain Unitarian Universalism. I think I did all right. Because what he understood is that what we think is that there is this love in the world, there is this capacity to transcend in the world that doesn't rely on what you believe about God exactly. So we got back to the idea of needing to mass market love. And our conversation then wandered off to the white woman who had tried to be black, and my companion wondered if her story had somehow been the event that threw the switch in the mind of the man in Charleston. And then he thought maybe it was because the Emmanuel AME church had become a multiracial church, and maybe that had bothered him. It was clear he was trying to understand the mind of that young man, trying to figure out how to undo what had been done. He said he was doing a mental autopsy. So I said the thing to him that I say to you frequently, let's go back upstream. Let's try not to catch the boat just as it goes over the waterfall. Let's go back before the church, before he purchases a firearm, before he takes pictures of himself with white supremacist patches on his jacket. Let's get back, way back, to those things that get into people's minds early that let people feel disconnected, that let people feel like other beings are objects that they can control rather than beings that we are utterly connected to. And that is the work of spiritual community, to work on those deepest assumptions and deepest ways of being in the world. And it's not tangible work, which is why it's frustrating and uncertain, and you never know if it's enough. But I think that's where the real change happens, not in the catching at the very last moment. And it's summer in New England, and so we have to balance the pleasure of this world in this season with this news, this story, and whatever may come next week. One little thing I can offer you is that there is a vigil planned for next Sunday at 4 o'clock in Market Square in Portsmouth. It's one small way that you can witness publicly. It's one way to look for the world that we want without violence, the world we want to live in. It's one way to live into this prayer by Nancy Taylor, who is the senior minister and CEO of Old South Church in Boston. She writes this to the historic Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church of Charleston, South Carolina, and she calls that church Mother Emmanuel. You who authored courageous slave rebellions, who suffered and survived wretched bigotry, burnings, and earthquake, you who worshipped underground when black churches were outlawed. Dear Mother Emmanuel, in this day of grievous heartache, we wrap you in bands of prayer. We pour out upon your broken hearts the healing balm of Gilead. You whose shepherd was taken from you, whose building has become a tomb, whose children are terrified, we stand with you. We weep with you. We rage for you. We keep vigil with you for your beloved dead. May the God of Moses and Miriam, of Jesus and Mary's, anoint you with healing, furnish you with hope, and one day, someday, mend your torn hearts and wipe the tears from your eyes. This is the work of the great turning that we talked about in the middle of winter. We talked about it as helping the earth itself, but it's all the same. It is learning to turn our minds to look at things differently. It is learning to turn away from all of the places where we are hopeless, where the relentlessness of the terror causes us to give up. It's easy to give up. And we must call each other to not give up, to continue to stand as witness, to continue to weep over what happens, to continue to rage over what happens, and to stand up in the world in all of the small and grand ways that are needed. So come next Sunday if you can. Find each other all summer and find ways to do small things that turn your mind your companions' minds that connect you to just a slightly wider circle of life than you are connected to at this moment. It will be uncomfortable. You will worry about making mistakes. And you know that is one of the gospels that I preach. Go out and make mistakes and make more contact. And we'll change the world.